Welcome to Author Stories, the podcast where we talk to the best writers in the industry and discuss writing and the creative process. Whether you are a writer, a reader, or both, we hope you'll find something here that makes you love books and the writers that create them. You can find archives of all of the great conversations I've had with authors over the years at hankgarner.com. Take some time and browse around there. I'm sure you'll find a new author to love, find inspiration for your own creative life, and find a new story to get lost in. Let's thank some sponsors who make the show possible. We're so happy to have our friend Crystal Pico Watanabe as a sponsor of the show. Crystal is one of the best editors in the business, and she has just debuted a new service that I think you'll absolutely love and will help you to up your writing game. Pico's School of Wordcraft and Editing has just debuted, and the first course is called Properly Punctuating Dialogue. It's a mini course and can be completed in just about 20 minutes. It covers the basics of dialogue punctuation. Authors can get access to the new school and the course for free by signing up for Crystal's author newsletter, Notes from Pico. Go to picoshouse.com/newsletters. That's PIKKOSHOUSE.com/newsletters. More in-depth courses will be added in 2020. Make sure you don't miss a thing. PicosHouse.com/newsletters. Unwilling Souls by Gregory D. Little. Books 1 and 2 are only 99 cents for a limited time. The gods are rightfully imprisoned, and Cess intends to keep them that way. But her terrorist father has other plans. Gregory D. Little's Unwilling Souls is a pulse-pounding chase through an epic fantasy world of adventure, sinister conspiracy, and a magical industrial revolution fueled by harvested human souls. Cess is the daughter of powerful parents who would very much like to kill one another and who therefore pretend she doesn't exist. An apprentice jailer of the gods, Cess spends her days learning to forge the tools needed to maintain the gods' prison. When her terrorist father attacks the prison on her 16th birthday, Cess is forced to flee after the secret of her parentage is revealed. Suddenly on the wrong side of the law, Cess realizes the very father who abandoned her may be the only one who can protect her. But some secrets are darker than parentage. On her way to find her father, Cess will uncover truths about her family and herself that will shatter her understanding of the world and risk the return of the gods themselves. Unwilling Souls and its sequel, Ungrateful God, are on sale now for only 99 cents. The third book of the series is coming early next year, so now is the perfect time to get up to speed. Unwilling Souls by Gregory D. Little. Books 1 and 2, only 99 cents for a limited time. Writers, I have an amazing tool to tell you about. A revolutionary writing tool for planning stories, Campfire Pro is what novelists need to go from the seed of an idea to a detailed plan that's ready to be executed. Complete your character design, create a timeline, and track your world building all in one place with our downloadable desktop app for Mac and PC. Without the annoying subscription model so many apps are using today, visit campfiretechnology.com for special holiday pricing on Campfire Pro today. Thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Jamie Castle on the show with me today. Jamie has become one of my favorite fantasy authors in the last couple of years. He's got a fantastic series that he co-writes with Rhett C. Bruno. It's called The Buried Goddess Saga. Amazing, amazing work. Jamie, I love these books because they give me kind of an old school sword and sorcery feel that I have not found in all of fantasy literature in quite some time. And I love what you guys are doing. I know you guys also have some science fiction stuff coming up, and we're going to talk all about that today. Welcome to the show, Jamie Castle.
Thanks, Hank. First of all, man, thank you for the compliment. That means a whole lot to me as a longtime fantasy fan. And, you know, maybe that's why you get some of the old school vibes. That's where I like to hang out. So thank you for that.
Well, I definitely get those vibes, and I get that you are also a big fan of a lot of the stuff that I'm a big fan of, and we can dig into that in just a minute. But we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
I can remember back early on in my life, I'm 35 years old. We'll throw that out there right away so that all
Still
the
getting
old
around by
guys.
yourself?
Yeah, I could still manage. I've got a walker that I use on occasion, but for the most part, I'm making it day to day. My first real memory was playing on my grandfather's Tandy 1000, which was a computer that Radio Shack made back in, I don't know, what was that, late 80s?
In the mid-80s to the mid-90s or so.
Yeah. And that was one of those computers that in so many ways looked like a modern day laptop in the regards that it was like a keyboard connected to the main computer unit and monitor. Everything was just all in one. And I recall several, I mean, God, I must have been 8 years old, 7 years old, maybe even younger than that. And he had on that Tandy 1000, there was about four different things that you could do. One of them was a drawing program, a very, very primitive drawing program that was more like a CAD software. And then there was a word processor on there. And I remember writing a story. I just finished listening to a teacher read or watching the movie The Pilgrim's Progress. And I remember wanting to write this kind of hero's journey story. Of course, I didn't know any of that terminology at the time, but I sat down and I wrote what I think was pretty basic. I was pretty young. But I do remember my mother asking me if I had plagiarized it. That was the first time I had ever heard the word plagiarize, because she actually liked it so much that she assumed I couldn't have written it, which was great. My mom had so much faith in me.
No
But then I.
lingering issues there at all,
Yeah.
huh?
Then I also made the book cover, which I've been a book cover artist and designer for as long as I could remember as well. And I remember playing with that kind of CAD software, and I made a book cover, which again was trash, I'm sure. But that was my very first memory of wanting to be a storyteller. 8 years old, 7 years old, something like that.
Isn't it funny that you didn't have the language to describe what you were doing, and you had not studied the hero's journey or, even been exposed to that concept, yet you knew what it was. Isn't it amazing that that journey, that the longing for a quest and the way to describe that to other people just comes innate. It's just a thing that's ingrained in us.
You could think back to the oldest verbal stories that we have. I mean, they were very much the same thing throughout cultures and time. Of course, in modern times, everything from Star Wars to, Lord of the Rings and just about everything in sci-fi fantasy for the last 50, 60 years have had some kind of hero's journey element to it. And so I think that any movies we've watched, anything like that, we just go, oh, this makes sense. Somebody like me, kind of a nobody, kind of a weakling, whatever you want to call. I'll call myself those things if I need to. Somebody like me needs to do something that somebody like me is totally incapable of doing. Therefore, I need somebody to help me do it and kind of help me help reveal who I am and who I'm meant to be and all of those things. It just comes with the storytelling. You want yourself to be the hero, and the only way you could do that is to kind of fabricate some kind of something that you don't have, and that's what the hero's journey is. And I think we all want to tell that story through our own lives.
Well, if you're 35, you were a 90s kid, primarily in your adolescence. There was a lot of good fantasy going around at the time then. What was your so from Pilgrim's Progress, then how did you discover what we think of as fantasy literature, and when did that love and desire start taking hold?
It was a weird, a really weird progression for me. Really, one of the first things I remember reading was the Bible. Believe it or not, I don't think many 11-year-olds have read the 750,000 words of the Bible, but I haven't stopped reading it since. I think that that is ultimately, even if you're not a Christian, I think that's ultimately the greatest story ever told. And if you have the whereabouts to take the time to understand the journey that takes place within that book, you'll find it to be a tremendous story. So I went from learning, kind of learning that I can read something that's intelligent, to going on to stuff like Michael Crichton. I do remember getting Jurassic Park taken away from me in school because I was reading at a time I wasn't supposed to be reading. And I was pissed because I was like right there at the climax of the story, and I was just, it was awful. And I was so upset. I don't even know if I ever got that book back. I think that it was ultimately taken from me. So Michael Crichton, the Congo Sphere, all of those. And then at one point, I started playing a game called Ultima Online, which to me was the greatest massive multiplayer RPG of all time. I believe it was one of the first, along with Asheron's Call and EverQuest, and in that time period there. I got obsessed with Ultima Online to the point where I was playing it from the time I got home from school at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon until literally 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning. I would go to sleep for about 2 hours, and then my mother would wake me up to go to school at 7 o'clock. And I did that for like entire years. Where I would just, and then Saturdays I would just sleep forever. And as a matter of fact, I had written a poem about a vampire. I'm giving you more information than you asked, but I wrote a poem. I was a poet for a while, probably still am because I'm a songwriter. But I wrote a poem about a vampire, and I had it hung above my bed. And my dad got so pissed off one day because he finally looked at it and read it. And he's like, "No wonder you sleep all day." And I had to get
Busted.
rid of the poem. So Ultima Online is what brought me to fantasy. My neighbor who played Ultima with me said, "By the way, have you ever read the Dark Elf books, Drizzt Do'Urden, by R.A. Salvatore?" And I went, "I don't know what any of those words you just said were, but I'm very interested."
Nice. I had the opportunity to interview Lord British Richard Garriott and Star Long at Dragon Con a couple of years ago, and the creators of Ultima Online. And that was like, I have several kind of huge geek moments that that I look back on pride with, and that was one of them. That was such an influential, and it's kind of our generation and younger have these crazy storytelling influences that have never been available before. And a lot of people don't, maybe don't consider gaming, as a big influence for storytelling. But how do you feel like that experience shaped what you love about story now?
First of all, I'm tremendously jealous that you got to meet those dudes because I'm telling you, that game set a foundation for everything that I've done since then. Every story I've ever told has some kind of massive multiplayer influence. There's a genre out, lit RPG, right now. I'm toying writing one with a friend of mine, Troy Osgood. Lit RPG is not really my genre as far as writing goes. I'm a fantasy writer, but those two genres are so closely linked. And because we're both gamers, as a matter of fact, he has a history with Ultima Online as well. It's amazing to me how here I am 20 years later, maybe more, 20 years later, and I'm still looking to Ultima Online as that influence that it was. It was, first of all, I believe that video games today, I have two small kids. I don't get to play video games as much as I would like to, but I do believe that video games have the best storytelling of any format and any medium that is in existence today. They are creating some of the most original stories that we've ever seen. They have the ability to write, quote, movies that don't have to be fully mainstream. See, the problem we have, I think, with movies today is that they're so expensive to produce, and it's kind of like a one and done situation. Somebody buys a ticket for $11 and they go and see the movie, and that's it. Like, you know, maybe they'll stream it later, maybe they'll go to the movie theater again, but the movie industry is so focused on having to put out things that sell that they're just going back to old movies that they knew sold at one point and kind of feeding on the nostalgia of guys my age and your age. Meanwhile, video games are $60 purchases that get played over and over again, and now we have the ability to have downloadable content. And so there's a risk-taking factor because they're telling a story as a movie. With the cutscenes that we have today and the videos throughout those, man, they're telling the tremendous stories with tremendous visuals, and they could be as creative as they want because their budget's not based upon nowadays we've got actors working in video games, but like, it's not the same. They're just doing whatever they want, and it's incredible.
Absolutely. So from Ultima, you then discover R.A. Salvatore. He was a big influence on me, probably more so on you. I know that you're a huge Salvatore fan. When that person recommended, you know, the Dark Elf books to you, and you had no point of reference when you got into those books, what happened?
I read The Crystal Shard. So there's two ways to read R.A. Salvatore. One is to start with the Dark Elf trilogy, which takes place in Menzo Baranzon, and it is chronologically, it's the first trilogy in the Drizzt books. Publish-release-wise, however you want to look at that, the Icewind Dale trilogy is the first ones that R.A. Salvatore wrote.
Did you play those games, by the way?
The Icewind Dale trilogy, or the Icewind Dale game. Sorry, man. I remember when I was in, it was still like my hacking days and my pirating days. As a young teen, I remember trying desperately to download Icewind Dale. I don't know what it was. I just wouldn't go out and buy it. I mean, I was young, so it's not like I had a bunch of money anyway. But it would never download, so I never, ever got to play Icewind Dale. There's my come get me FBI.
Oh, man. I have the – you know, they remastered those games a couple years ago, and I got the remasters, and they're still amazing.
Baldur's Gate, I do have – I mean, I've played all the Baldur's Gates, and I think that they are some of the greatest games of all time. So, yeah, I mean, I did. So I read Icewind Dale before I read the Menzo Baranzon books, and I'm actually really glad I did it that way because I didn't really love the Dark Elf trilogy. Icewind Dale opened up this unbelievable world to me imagination-wise. I still can remember – like the very first time I read the first book, Crystal Shard, three times in a row. I remember like Regis, the little halfling, and him, like, I can't think of the word where you whittling. There we go. Whittling from fish bones and like getting into his head. That's like the intro, kind of the beginning of it. He's in a place called Ten Towns, and like he's making these little figurines out of bones, and I'm going, this is so it was so weird as a I don't know how to explain it other than that, because everything I had read up until that point took place in founded on Earth, you know, like all those Michael Crichton books. Yeah, there were fantasy aspects, but there was nothing that was outside of the realm of Earth, and he created these brand new worlds. And he didn't create them. They're Forgotten Realms and Dungeons and Dragons, but in my mind, he created them. And so Crystal Shard and Icewind Dale was a huge foundation for my writing.
What do you think it is about those kinds of stories that, these are, ancient stories, really, mm-hmm. with characters that, from a distant past or, another world that's inaccessible to us. And we love these stories with these seemingly primitive people and primitive settings while we are, you know, playing games on our Xboxes and, you know, we're talking with each other across the world, you know, over the internet, but we're still drawn to these stories that are so out of time and out of mind, to us, with fantastical races of people and, magic and all of this stuff. What is it that draws us back to these kinds of stories over and over again?
There's just like such a gentle joy to experiencing life through vicariously through these characters who have never been. Let me put it this way. You and I live in a world where we are really bound and restricted in so many ways. There's a lot of freedom that we experience, but at the same time, like, I live in a house and I have kids that I have to take care of. And I have a wife who I love dearly, but I have to be here with her. These characters get to do whatever the hell they want to do, whenever they want to do it. There's this – I mean, Lord of the Rings, R.A. Salvatore, all of these – man, these characters just go on grand adventures. And, of course, we don't get to see all the dirty, nasty stuff of them having to poop in the woods and wipe with leaves. And so we don't see in the books – we don't see – I mean, maybe you do. Maybe there are some books that go that deep, you know. But at the same time, we get the fantastical aspects of going to new and amazing cities and meeting these wizards that we don't actually know are wizards, but they're doing these amazing things. And there's just this vicarious living that I think is done through – I mean, what little boy didn't want to be a swashbuckling swordsman, right? Or like some wizard or you know, whatever. What little girl didn't want to shoot a bow and arrow and, you know, do all of these things that or you know, whatever. I don't know. My little girl, of course, she has an older brother, but like she wants to do all of those things. She is a girl's girl, like, to the extreme, but she still wants to be that hero. Even if it's the princess hero that she sees in Disney, we want to do those things. And man, there's just such a draw for me to live in those days, I think, where we could just adventure and eat salted fish and dried meat at a campfire while trying not to get stabbed in the neck by a ringwraith. I don't know. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, it's such an amazing, like, I just said a crazy sentence that's never been said in any other time in history.
Right.
It's amazing. It's incredible.
It is incredible. And if I remember right, you devoured everything, that Salvatore had written. When did the desire come back to tell your own story in a world like that? You know, and I think every storyteller, everyone that I've ever met, just about had, you know, these grand desires to write, you know, an epic fantasy. That there's just something about those stories because they resonate so deeply with all of us that we want to try our hand at it as well. Very few people actually do. And now, you know, you're working on book 6 of this massive series that you actually did. When did that desire start coming back around? And where did the Buried Goddess saga come from?
I probably have dates wrong, but I'll make them up and it'll sound like I really have my thoughts together. It was like 1999 when I first read Icewind Dale, Crystal Shard, and I immediately started writing a fantasy novel. I don't even know that I finished reading book 1 of that Icewind Dale trilogy before I started penning a book of my own. That book was called the Tinsdar Chronicles. Book 1 was called Suspended in Dusk, and it was this story of a young boy named Dross, I think was what I named him, which is so close to Drizzt, I'm embarrassed. Drost Buer, I think, was his name. And the idea was – it was pretty interesting because later on there was a bit of a Morrowind feel to it. Like he woke up on a ship and – you know, I think a lot of us tend to do the whole amnesia thing as some of our first stories that we tell because it's so much easier to reveal a world to readers when the character himself is becoming – or herself is becoming aware of the things around them. And so he woke up on a ship and kind of didn't know where he was. And then all of a sudden he's in a tavern with all of these other party members or soon to be party members.
Because taverns.
Yeah, man. Very tropey. The whole thing was very tropey. As a matter of fact, I started off the Buried Goddess Saga in a tavern on purpose. A little bit tongue in cheek. And, you know, the story itself, the Buried Goddess Saga itself is very, lighthearted, but like hiding darkness. It's very, very dark. It's very, very, you know, there's some grim dark elements to it that I think that we did a great job of disguising lightheartedly. If I can say so myself, but we started it out in a tavern on purpose. And I'm sure there were plenty of fantasy readers that went, oh, I can't do this. I'm not even going to read this if it starts out in a tavern. But my hope is that people would get through the farm boy aspect of it. Because again, those things were done on purpose. And he's Whitney Firestone is not a farm boy by any means. But at the intro, we kind of got that feel, and then he went on to do what he did. But, 1999, I started writing the first one. I've read the manuscript recently. It was absolute garbage. I had no idea where I was going. I'm a pantser. I write into the dark. And it was very clear and very evident that I did that with no knowledge of where I was going to go whatsoever. The great aspects of that book, Suspended in Dusk, was that the god's name in the Buried Goddess Saga, I am, came from that original manuscript. And that was about as much as that 90,000 words offered me.
But did you smile when you went back and read it?
In a cringe-worthy way. Now, I'll be honest, man. There were some things in there that I went, oh, that's not bad. I remember cracking open the manuscript and thinking this is going to be absolutely awful, because it was like 15 to 17-year-old Jamie, and I just expected it to be bad. But there were parts of it that I was pleasantly surprised. I was like, wow, this was not actually that bad. The writing was fine. The storytelling was just lacking. So, I smiled. I laughed. I cringed a lot. But it was cool. It was fun to go back and see.
Yeah. And if you I'm guessing that you probably recognized yourself in that. And even in its primitive state and its, you know, unrefined, you know, craft ability and all that, that storytelling desire was probably there intact, wasn't it?
For sure. I mean, I am me, right? And I will always be me. And the coolest aspect, I think, I would really suggest I know that a lot of writers listen to your program. That's how I found you. Which, by the way, your show is the best show out there. I have to say that while I'm on the air, just to let you know, your show is absolutely the best craft and story show that exists. I love listening.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, man. But that said, you know, I would suggest every author listening, every writer listening, goes back to their early works and reads it. One of the main reasons that I suggest that is because you get to see where you've come from. It's so easy in this industry to feel like you're not progressing, because writing is very, very hard, and it's very, very lonely, and it takes a long, long time. And you're writing a 100,000 words, 500 pages, however you look at that. Even if it's a shorter book, you're writing so many thousands of words a day and a week that you fail to recognize when you're progressing. It's like when you look in the mirror every day and you don't notice that you're aging, but then you see somebody that you haven't seen in 20 years and they comment on how much you've aged. Or, you know, you do one of these Facebook challenges like is going around right now, where it's like show your 2009 picture versus your 2019 picture, and you go, holy crap, I used to look like a normal human being. That's what happens in your writing. You go back and you go, man, I've gotten better at what I do.
Yes, yes. So somewhere along the way, you meet Rhett C. Bruno, another fantastic writer who's been on
the show before.
He's okay. He's all right. He's okay. And you guys devise to co-write this epic fantasy series. So What was the origin of this particular story? I know we've talked about how you know, some things you brought over from beginning, but how did you and Rhett get together and how did you convince him to write this epic fantasy series with you?
Well, for starters, the very first thing that he and I wrote together was a sci-fi book called The Luna Missile Crisis.
Which is coming out soon.
Yeah, February 20th. Now, we wrote this book about 2.5 to 3 years ago. Excuse me. We wrote this book about 2.5 to 3 years ago together. It was the first introduction to each other that we had. We met through – I helped them design a logo for something called Sci-Fi Bridge. Rhett C. Bruno is one of the guys that runs it. And so we worked together on that, and then Luna Missile Crisis was a book book that he had started writing. He was about 25,000 words into it for authors, for readers that – I don't know. He was about 5 chapters into it, and he had a lot of trouble – his own words, not mine. He had a lot of trouble writing something that was so grounded in Earth. Luna Missile Crisis, although it's sci-fi, it's like an alternate history of the 1960s Cold War that involves aliens, and it's a fun book. He read some of my work and noticed the comedic aspect of my work. I do write serious stuff, but there's always comedy in it. I'm a joke teller and a goofball, and so there's always a tongue-in-cheek, sarcasm, whatever you want to call it. And that, he said, that's what the book needed. Rhett's a very serious writer, and I like to think that over the last 3 years I've helped pull out some of the comedy, because he'll write some stuff every now and then that I laugh out loud at, and that was not represented in like Titanborn and The Circuit, especially not The Circuit. The Circuit was so freaking like dour and like just raw. And so Luna Missile Crisis, we got together, we finished that book. And once we were done with that, he went on to kind of work on one of the Titan books, the Children of Titan books. And we hadn't made any commitment to one another as far as being partners in writing. We just wrote a book together and actually didn't know what to do with it after that. We both self-published at the time, so it's not like we didn't know how to self-publish. We felt like there was something special about Luna Missile Crisis, and we didn't want to just throw it to the wind and hope it catches. But during the time that we were trying to figure out who's going to publish this, what direction are we going to go, he started working on the Children of Titan books again, and I started writing something that ultimately ended up being called Web of Eyes. book one of the Buried Goddess Saga. I didn't get very far into it before I texted him and I said, "Hey man, would you read this and tell me what you think?" Because I had never really written fantasy at the time. Like, I wrote stuff, like I told you, back in like 99, I wrote, you know, crap fantasy that I didn't do anything with. I wrote 90,000 words in that book, which, by the way, readers, is almost a complete book in some ways. And then just like, it just did nothing. I just threw it out the door because it was just garbage. So there's 90,000 words written in 1999. And then all of a sudden, like 2017, I'm writing this fantasy again. And so I showed it to him. He goes, "Okay, what you have here is this really fun buddy cop fantasy story between a guy named Torsten Unger and Whitney Firestone. But what I was doing was trying to tell this massive epic. So there was like politics and there was like armies and all of these things going on in the first like 30,000 words of this book." It's funny. I wrote about the same of Web of Eyes as he had written of Luna Missile Crisis when we asked each other to get involved. So Rhett looks at it, and he did so much work on it, he said, "Why don't we just write this together?" And I don't think Rhett really wanted to get involved in fantasy at the time, but I'm beyond happy that he did, because that the Buried Goddess Saga really solidified our friendship and our writing relationship. And I don't look at Luna Missile Crisis as Rhett's book that I joined, and he doesn't look at Web of Eyes as like my book that he joined, and we don't look at those things vice versa that way either. They're our books together, because they were both basically rewritten from the ground up. But that's how Buried Goddess came to be. Lunar Missile Crisis, which hasn't been released after about 3 years, led to a book series that's almost fully released and doing fairly well.
The you know, there's a, and we talked about this great desire to write fantasy, especially for fans of fantasy. And I read your first book, Brother Dust, and while it had some fantasy elements, it also has some sci-fi elements and, you know, some speculative fiction elements. It's kind of all over the place in a good way. When you started writing Buried Goddess, did it just feel right? Was this, did you ever stop and go, oh my God, I can't believe I'm actually getting to do this and, you know, people are liking it and this feels like a story I was, you know, sort of meant to tell?
So Brother Dust, I released about 3 years ago, and I've since unreleased it, if that's a word, unpublished it, and I'm rewriting it, and I'm going to be re-releasing it next year, because what it was, exactly like you said, it was kind of a mashup. It was I called it a space opera for fans of superheroes. Well, after establishing a relationship with Rhett, he's helped me developmentally edit that book, and so he's helped me to take it from, I don't know, really very, because it started as a comic book. Brother Dust started as a comic book, and so it has a very superhero feel to it. He helped me pull that all back and make it very space opera-y. But the fantasy elements, like you were saying, the fantasy elements were there. I think I've always wanted to write fantasy, even in my science fiction. So the transition to Buried Goddess Saga really wasn't all that difficult. And writing fantasy for me comes very naturally because I've read so much of it, as well as, like, I don't love science fiction in regards to technology and any of the hard sci-fi aspects. So a lot of my science fiction is fantasy-based anyway.
Yeah, so, space fantasy is my sci-fi.
I do my best to make the sci-fi – I want to make the science work. I don't like a lot of hand-wavium. I don't like to have the reader just suspend their disbelief to a point where they can't do it anymore. But in the same fashion, fantasy, you don't have to worry about much of any of that. It's an adventure. It's politics. It's swords and sorcery. And magic doesn't have to have any explanation as long as what you've made up makes sense. The magic systems work very much like science, but it's science that you get to create. So in our series, it's blood magic, and we've done our best to stay as true to – in order to do magic, there has to be blood involved, and I think we've managed that. Sorry again. So that said, I don't even remember what the original question was, so I hope I answered it.
Yes, yes, you did. So when you guys start building the world, you mentioned blood magic. How, when you're, you know, taking this journey with these characters and you know that magic is going to play a role, but obviously you don't want everyone in the story, you know, to be epic magic users, because there would be no tension to the story. That it has to be something that's used sparingly, or if, you know, it, there has to be a purpose to it, and it has to not be the solution to everything. How do you decide what role magic plays and when to implement it, you know, for the character's sake, or to withhold it for the character's sake, for the reader's sake of, you know, going on more adventure?
Well, the interesting thing, I think, for me at least, of Web of Eyes was I do write into the dark. I write what I call pantsing. I don't necessarily know what's going to happen throughout the story. All I sort of know is the beginning and the end. There was a character that showed up in the middle of the book named Sora, who I believe is probably the fan favorite at this point. She was not at all planned. She showed up when I wrote her name. As a matter of fact, one of the chapters is Whitney encountering Sora, and he says, "Sora?" And the chapter ends. And I remember Rhett and I talking because I write Whitney, Rhett writes Torsten, and we pass them back and forth. And so we both have involvement in those characters, but Whitney is, by all definitions, my character to write. I remember showing it to him and he went, "Who the hell is Sora?" And I went, "Let's find out." And that's exactly what happened. Sora ended up becoming the basis for understanding magic in our story. Every character that uses magic developed from Sora's use of magic that we had no idea how it was going to work or what it was going to be, and it just shaped itself around her.
That's awesome. Speaking of writing into the dark, and you know, that's a term that I think our friend Dean Wesley Smith popularized for as a better way to describe pantsing or writing by the seat of your pants, which, you know, we all say tongue in cheek, but it's a little offensive to people that write that way, and I mostly write that way. But when you're collaborating with someone, and not only collaborating with someone, but collaborating on a series that you know, you guys are about to publish in a couple months, book six. You know, have you guys known where you were going with book six all along, and how do you balance planning out a series while leaving yourself the freedom to write into the dark? And what do you think writing into the dark gives you creatively that maybe a detailed plotter misses?
I usually do these interviews with Rhett because I guarantee you there's things he wouldn't want me to say publicly that I don't have any filter enough to keep to myself. We had no idea where Buried Goddess was going. I actually remember when I first started writing it and I asked him to come on board and help me actually do it right. I had planned, I'm like, it's going to be five books. And I just had names of books and none of them stuck around except Web of Eyes. And he's like, okay, so what happens? I'm like, I don't know. They're cool names. Web of Eyes, the only reason I wrote the book was because I had this cool like play on words. I'm like, Web of Eyes, that's really cool. How do I write a book about that? And that's how the Spider Queen and all of those things were developed, was just from the name Web of Eyes. I had no idea where the story was going. As a matter of fact, I had no intention of the gods becoming tangible or like real. In my mind, they were just constructs of the characters. And then Rhett decided, no, if we're going to talk about them throughout every single book and the series is going to be called the Buried Goddess Saga, these gods are going to actually play a role in the series. And I'm like, oh, okay, cool. It's fine with me. I had just never really read any fantasy up until that point where the gods did have actual influence outside of like bards singing songs and clerics praying prayers. So, we didn't have six books planned. As a matter of fact, I think both of us, as we were moving forward, we really wanted to keep it to three books because if I could just be kind of candid, the books weren't selling really well at the start. We learned later on that fantasy is just difficult to sell because fantasy readers have been burned so many times by authors like George R. R. Martin and Patrick Rothfuss, who started series and then seemingly will never end them. You know, and then of course, I think the Robert Jordan fans got lucky because Brandon Sanderson got to take over and did a phenomenal job, writing a book series that I don't like. But that, you know, and Hank, you and I did a podcast. We could be honest about that, right? Jamie Castle, Hank Garner, and Josh Hayes did a podcast together on the Wheel of Time
until we could no longer stand it.
Yeah, man, it was just we did about three episodes, and I think it was widely accepted. I mean, people liked it. They liked to hear what we had to say, even though they hated what we had to say. But I didn't like Wheel of Time. None of us liked it. And but that said, like, fantasy readers wait until a series is done before they catch on to it because they want to make sure they're going to get a finished story. So we had written two books at the time. And we're like, okay, let's end this at book three because we don't really know if anyone's ever going to read this series. So we started writing book three and it became twice as long as book two. And the story still wasn't done. And we said, well, crap, let's make it four. And then we went, let's just make it six. And we are discovering what book six is and how book six ends right now. The joy of writing together is that Rhett will write something that I'll go, whoa, I didn't even think about doing that. And I'll write something that hopefully he goes, wow, I didn't even expect that to happen. And so we know what's going to happen. We actually know exactly what's going to happen with each character, each main character. We just don't know how it's going to happen. And so it's a fun process.
So five books are out now presently. Do you when this series wraps up, is that going to be it for these characters? Are you thinking of other fantasy series or can you even get outside your creative head right now to think about what might come next?
Oh, I never stop thinking about what comes next. As a matter of fact, the challenge of finishing this book is that I want to write other books. Rhett and I have a sci-fi trilogy planned called The Bionic Supremacy, which we're very, very excited about writing. We've been kicking it around for probably the last year. And fighting every urge to start writing it. I'm going to be finishing up Brother Dust, the rewrite of Brother Dust, and publishing that. I have another fantasy work in progress right now called The Secret King. The Secret King was originally supposed to be the origins of a character called Kazimir from the Buried Goddess Saga. He's an Upire, which is actually pronounced Upir, but if you listen to the books, Luke Daniels thought that I had made up the word, I guess, or thought that we had made up the word. And sorry, Luke, if you're listening, man, I'm not throwing you under the bus, but Upir is actually it's U-P-Y-R. It's another word for vampire in another language and dialect. So Kashmir's an Upir, and it was supposed to be the origins of the Upir, but we actually ended up doing that in book five. Which is funny. I started writing this long before book five became a thing, and I went, let's just do it here in this series. Why not? So if I ever go back to The Secret King, which I hope I do, it's a story about a girl named Callista Makara, and it's a post-apocalyptic fantasy book where there's zombies, and it's a lot of fun.
Nice. Speaking of Luke Daniels, audio has you've released audio versions of each of these books as they've come out. Mm-hmm. With the latest one, book five, War of Men, and the inestimable Luke Daniels has narrated them. I'm a huge Luke Daniels fan. We had him on the show talking about the first book that came out. What has that been like having someone that I know you respect and you enjoy his work reading your words and bringing your characters to life?
Luke has been my narrator of choice for as long as I've been listening to audiobooks. I listen to at least 150 books a year. I listen more than I read, and I listen more than I watch movies or television. And I've listened to so many Luke Daniels books that when Audible Studios came to us with an offer on this series, I had no other options in my mind. They gave us other options, and the other options were tremendous options. Oliver Wyman, who's a good friend of mine, and Ray Porter, who is a tremendous, amazing narrator. They both did auditions. They were both absolutely incredible auditions, and we would have been blessed and lucky to have either one of those doing the series. But I had asked for Luke Daniels, and they also gave us the audition from Luke Daniels, and for me, there was no choice. Rhett was like, but these guys did a great job too, are you sure? And I said, I got to have Luke Daniels. Luke did the thing that Luke does better than anyone in the industry is voices. A lot of people didn't like the Wyrm Firestone's voice in book one. If I can make a plea to anyone who has listened to one and went, I can't stand Wyrm Firestone, I'm going to tell you that I've listened to every one of them, and he gets far less leprechaun as the series goes on. I don't know what it is, it doesn't matter. But Luke was still trying to find his voice, I think. But he becomes the most incredibly hilarious representation of me that I've ever desired. And then we got Ray to narrate the Luna Missile Crisis. So we got Ray anyway. And Oliver, I hope we'll do some of my personal stuff in the future as well. So there is no way to describe the feeling of listening to one of my books narrated by Luke Daniels. There's no descriptive words to it's amazing.
Well, the series is amazing. I've told you several times that, you know, I have looked for a while for a series that really scratched that itch that I had. And I don't think that it's just nostalgia. I think there's obviously some of that. You know, the things that you first love always kind of hold a special place in your heart. But sometimes those things don't stand up. And, you know, if you... And I told this to Terry Brooks when he was, you know, on the show. You go back and read the first Shannara book, and that's, you know, you couldn't publish that book today
right.
because nothing happens in the first 150 pages.
Right.
You know, it's a lot of, it's very tropey. And you know, he admits that, and we had a laugh about it. But, so nostalgia's not enough, but... You know, this book series really, and I'm glad that you mentioned the grimdark elements because while there's really some serious stuff that goes on in the book and some kind of gnarly stuff, you really do make it a joy to read. Like I have not come to a point in this series where I've just been like, oh God, man, can we get through this? You know, it's just I love
Thank
it.
You, man.
I love it. So I love what you guys are doing. Have you come to a point in writing the series where, you have to be careful to keep your influences in check, and make sure that you're, you know, plowing new ground and you know, not just falling, to the typical tropes? Like, how do you stay fresh with your writing while having this kind of vast back catalog in your head of fantasy, you know, literature from the last 20 years?
One of the great things about co-writing is that you constantly have somebody going, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that, on both sides of the coin. You know, there's so much grimdark out there right now, which to some extent or degree I like, you know, but I also think that it's very
I have to take it in doses.
Yeah, it's representative, I think, of the political climate right now, and it's frustrating to me because I go to read fantasy to escape from the bullshit that I experience on a day-to-day basis. If I'm allowed to swear, I'm sorry if I'm not. And so, you know, there's this idea that like just everybody's evil and everybody's got this plan and I don't write strictly black and white characters, neither does Rhett. As a matter of fact, Rhett is very gray in his writing style. But one of the things that we have had to be careful of is that we both enjoy things like Game of Thrones, The Expanse, these stories where there's very, very gray storytelling, and neither of us necessarily minds graphic things in our books, but we've not created that particular kind of a series. As a matter of fact, we've prided ourselves on it being fairly family friendly. Now, as you get deeper, just like even Harry Potter starts out very fantastical and very childish, and then all of a sudden it's freaking dark and I can't even let my 5-year-old watch books 3 through 7 or 8, you know? But with that in mind, like there was a review that we got recently, and I get it. Reviews are for readers, not for authors. But it's very hard as an author to not read all of your reviews and just kind of see where everybody's at. And there was something that happened in book 4 that they felt was out of place and not okay for the series. And I won't spoil anything. But that was something that Rhett and I thought very, very hard about. As a matter of fact, one of our beta readers, who's a good friend and a co-author, his name is Brian Mansur, actually, great writer. He has read everything that we've written and given us feedback on everything. And he came back to us on book 4 and he said, I don't know that this is okay. I rewrote the whole scene because we had what we wanted was one of our characters to experience a certain thing that would set a foundation for the rest of the series. It was an emotional and mental thing that they needed to go through to grow as a character. And I rewrote it to try to come up with another way of getting the same emotional value out of it. And I showed it to him, and Brian said, "You're absolutely right. There's no better way to do it than you did it." And so Rhett and I had to go, if we're going to write a series that's for adult human beings, then we're going to deal with adult issues. And this is a real adult issue. And so we did it. We didn't do it graphically. We didn't do it gratuitously. But at the same time, we knew people, there were going to be some people that didn't like it. And that's just the price that you pay to tell stories about real people. And of course, I know they're not real, but they're real to me.
Well, Stephen King said something about, you know, we're dealing with the human condition and our own, place in this world by telling lies about people that we make up.
Right.
And you can't do that. I'm sorry. No matter what you think, we live in a fallen world of sorts, and this is what you get.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, the Buried Goddess Saga, we are up to book 5 now. Book 6 comes out around February, is that right?
We have a pre-release date for February 25th for the ebook and the print. We don't know when audio is going to hit. Luke Daniels is a very, very busy dude, and we know that he's, for these last couple of books, he's been a bit behind on releasing audio, but we would hope that audio for Word of Truth, which is book 6, we hope that that would come no later than the summer 2020.
Well, I read the first book, and then I held off on any more letting you guys catch up because I love to binge through a series, and I couldn't wait any longer, and I've been tearing through them, and I'm so loving the series.
Thanks, man.
I can't wait for book 6. Jamie, thank you so much for coming on the show today. Tell people where they can find you online if they want to dig into all the good stuff that you do.
You can go to jamiecastle.com. It's spelled J-A-I-M-E, jamiecastle.com. You can find me on Facebook. I'm very active on social media, Facebook especially. So, you know, you could join the King's Shield, which if you go to Facebook and search the King's Shield, that's kind of the fan club. You get a lot of first looks at things and oftentimes, you know, freebies that other people don't have access to, including free audiobooks. And so I'm there. You could check out my publisher's website, aethonbooks.com. There's a lot of ways that you could find me. If you just want the books and you want them on audio, audible.com, you can search The Buried Goddess Saga, search that on Amazon as well. I think that's it. I think those are the places that I am most active.
We will put links to all of that in the show notes of this episode, and we're going to send everybody to see you. Thanks so much for coming on, Jamie.
Thank you, Hank.
Thanks for tuning in to Author Stories. Stay tuned for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane series.
The ancient building wore the severe cassock colors of a Puritan minister, a uniform monochrome of slate-gray shingles and soot-gray clapboards, its shadowed upper windows cross-hatched like the facets of a spider's eye. The second story protruded beyond the first and bore the house's only ornament, two gray teardrops of wood, weeping from each corner of the building's stiff upper lip. The place would have looked sinister and foreboding in its shadowed alley if not for the die-cut silhouette of a dancing sheep, jaunty above the door, and the two front bay windows that blazed with colorful, welcoming light. The windows were hung with orbs of colored glass on staggered lengths of ribbon. Each orb glowed with autumnal reds and delicate greens, burgundy tints and pumpkin hues, dappled raspberry and clover lime, streaked with light and weightless as bubbles over a cauldron. The shelves below offered crystal skulls and silver daggers and horny devils, Celtic chalices and woven dream catchers in dreamcoat hues. A primitive broom leaned in a corner, ready for flight, and a rhapsodic nude in bronze clutched her goat-legged lover beneath a jackal bust of Anubis. The interior of the shop was even witchier. Above a crude and sooty fireplace, A stack of brick barely holding the shape of a chimney pushed through the barn-high roof, threading ancient beams that crisscrossed overhead. Brooms and kettles and Christmas lights dangled from these, alongside Halloween costumes and Chinese umbrellas, pointy hats and bundles of herbs. Jason wandered deeper into the shop. His fingers trailed across strange bronze statuary and Aztec masks of turquoise and lapis lazuli. He rolled his eyes at the luck candles and money charms, but goggled indecently at a nude and anatomically correct silver nymph with long golden hair that reminded him of Kate.
"See anything you like?"
Jason jumped, turned, and jumped again. The woman standing before him was the living embodiment of every hippy-dippy counterculture type he'd ever seen. Her hair was green, her face pale and round, her doughy body wrapped in some elaborately woven ethnic garb. Her eyebrows were black and pierced in little rows, and her eyes were heavily circled with midnight blue, as if she'd been sucker-punched by an oil slick. She tapped the glass over the nymph.
"Admiring the goddess, I see."
Oh, she'd practically caught him with porn.
"You want to hold her? She won't break. Here."
The woman flipped open a glass door and handed Jason the naked figure.
"See how heavy she is? You could bang her against the wall all day and barely make a dent."
She waggled her eyebrows, obviously enjoying his discomfort. He checked the price tag.
$700? "The goddess is a symbol of love and fertility. Don't be ashamed of desiring her."
The woman's long green fingernails plucked a long black cigarette from a long red case, and she lit it.
"I sense,"
she blew smoke and studied its whorls,
"dissatisfaction in love. Yes, I have just the thing."
She pulled Jason into a side room where the smell of her clove smoke gave way to the skunky aromas of potpourri sachets, tea leaves, and hanging clutches of twiggy flowers. She searched, found a little bundle, and pressed it into his hand.
"This will make you irresistible. Rub it on your nethers twice a day, and love shall surely find you."
Jason made a face. The bundle smelled like cow manure. He didn't even want that on his hands.